Good evening. We are continuing with our study of Lojong, Cultivating Compassion. And the topic for tonight is point 5, Evaluation of Mind Training. And there are 4 slogans, and they are numbered 19 through 22. So everyone, or almost everyone, has a sheet or access to a sheet, I think.
Do you need?
Yeah, that was from last week. You don't need that. It's in the back of your book.
You can share it, and you can print this out online. So we've been going through the 7 points of mind training in order, at least up till tonight. Point 1 was first train in the preliminaries. Point 2 is the main practice, which is training in bodhicitta. And that had 2 parts, absolute bodhicitta and relative bodhicitta. And that was the meat of the whole instruction. Point 3 is transforming of bad circumstances into the path of enlightenment, which is taking the obstacles and turning them into strengths that will help us on the path. This can also be called alchemy. Point 4 is showing the utilization of practice in one's whole life, that is, how to take the teachings and bring them into everything we do, everything that we experience, so there's no corner of our life that's excluded. And then it turns out wonderfully that if we bring the teachings completely into how we live, it also turns out to be the correct instruction for how to meet our death, which every one of us will have to do at some point. So there's a wonderful economy. We don't learn 2 different things, one for living and one for dying. Saves us a lot of time. So that is point 1 through point 4. And if there's any urgent issue that comes up, or there's a question, or there's something you want to talk about, we can do that now. And if not, which is fine, I'll just go on. So we are on point 5, evaluation of mind training. Mind training here is the same as Lojong. Lojong is training of the mind. So we have been instructed in the practice of Lojong. We've talked about how to work with obstacles and how to bring it into our entire life. But we have lots of resistance. Every one of us is kicking back and screaming in all kinds of ways. We've been hearing it from all of you. We, the teachers of this course, are in the same situation. We have lots of resistance. Do we really want to do Lojong? Even hearing it makes us uncomfortable. It invites us to look at things we don't really want to see about ourselves. It invites us to go where we really do not want to go. And it's very upsetting to our general, well-established habit and routine of protecting ourselves first. So there's all sorts of issues that come up. So point 5 is asking us to evaluate our mind training. What is the benefit of Lojong? What is the point of doing it? And is my practice effective? Am I doing it in a good way that will work? So does anyone have any thoughts about this? You don't have to agree with anything. You can kick hard if you want.
The whole thing about sort of saying letting ego go is really hard. If you think the goal is to let the ego go. It's like, you know, I was sitting here tonight and I was meditating and then suddenly I was like, oh, I did a really nice talk about meditation the other week and I was sort of patting myself on the, oh, that's terrible. And then it's like, if there's that, like, and there's that piece of, you know, if you're going to do stuff, don't you want to do it well? And then how do you do it well and not
feel a sense of accomplishment?
Yeah, do a little pat on the back or think, well, I don't have an ego, so I don't have to do it well. I mean, sort of like there's that piece that, I think because we're so caught up with our ego, like the idea of just, letting go of whether it was good or bad, and if people liked it or not.
So we have all kinds of contradictions flying, don't we? And they're sort of subtle, and they're echoing themselves all over the place.
I think it's also not about sort of, okay, I did that, and then you layer on top of that, oh good, you know, now I'm even better, and then I'm even better. And there's some kind of building up over time. But it's more a sense of just being able to, I gave meditation and offer and let go. So it's not this self-reference point all the time. That's where we get hooked. It's not that we don't feel good about offering something helpful to people, feel good about it, but we don't have to have it reflect back on us necessarily. It doesn't have to be our, it can be an accomplishment, but it's not something we have to hold on to and get puffed up about. That's the main thing, I think.
I'd like to say something about, ask about number 22, slogan 22.
Oh, we're going to come to that. Today we're going to come to that.
We're going to do 19 through 22 today.
Michael will cover it. We're starting at 19.
Yeah, 19 through 22 today.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's fine. We'll
get there.
We'll get there somehow or other, I hope.
Or we will.
We will. So I think it feels to me like my mind is a big echo chamber with reverberations that, did I not? What did I not? So there's room to get pretty confused about all this.
I find, just to continue to speak about this a little bit, that this, those first two all dharmas agree at one point, and number two witnesses hold the principal one. That, you know, this notion of a separation between those who are witnessing oneself and then oneself.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the crux. You know, there's a big hook there, definitely. And to realize, I think that's this, that second of the two witnesses hold the principal one is pretty like in my mind what it's saying is come back, be aware, like you're the only one who can really see if you're closing down or you're opening up. It's all down to you. But it's not you at the same time. But I find that really important and interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Is it okay if we take them in order?
Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Yes.
No, that's okay. Well, you could do it a different way. Just if you have to throw this away.
Oh, no. We wouldn't want to disturb you.
Well, I can be disturbed a little bit, but let's start with slogan 19. All Dharma agrees at one point. So in this particular slogan, the word Dharma means all the Buddhist teachings and practices we are given. There's another way in which Dharma is used to mean all phenomena, everything in the world exactly as it is. But here it means it's much more restricted. The teachings and the practice. All Dharma agrees at one point. So what does that mean? Is it kind of explaining why we keep repeating ourselves? Okay, going on. All Dharma agrees at one point. I'd like to read a little bit. First from Pema Chodron.
That's Trungpa.
That's Trungpa. Okay, let's start with Pema Chodron. It's quite a juggling act here. So, she's saying about this slogan, one might think that we're talking about ego as enemy, about ego as original sin, but this is a very different approach, a much softer approach. Rather than original sin, there's original soft spot. The messy stuff that we see in ourselves and that we perceive in the world as violence and cruelty and fear is not the result of some basic badness, but of the fact that we have such a tender, vulnerable, warm heart of bodhicitta, which we instinctively protect so that nothing will touch it. This is a life-affirming view. It starts from the point of basic goodness or basic good heart. The problem is that we continually grab the wrong end of the stick. All practice agrees that there's some fundamental pattern that we have in which we're always trying to avoid the unpleasantness and grasp the pleasantness. There seems to be a need to change the fundamental pattern of always protecting against anything touching our soft spot. Tonglen practice is about changing the basic pattern. You don't have to drive up in a big machine and smash the whole thing to pieces. Rather, at your own speed, starting where you are, you begin to open the door and the windows. It's a very gentle approach, one that acknowledges that you can gradually begin to open the door. And now I'm going to read from Trungpa Rinpoche, who is, of course, her teacher. In the Hinayana, that is the small vehicle concerned with our own liberation, our ego begins to get a haircut. Its beard is shaved. In the Mahayana, the great vehicle in which we put others first, the limbs of ego are cut, so there are no longer any arms and legs. We even begin to open up the torso of ego. By developing ultimate bodhicitta, we take away the heart so that nothing exists at all. Then we try to utilize the leftover mess of cut-off arms and legs and heads and hearts, along with lots of blood. Applying the bodhisattva approach, we make use of them. We don't throw them away. We don't want to pollute our world with lots of leftover egos. Instead, we bring them onto the path of Dharma by examining them and making use of them. So whatever happens in your life becomes a way of measuring your progress on the path, how much you have been able to shed your limbs, your torso, and your heart. Well, gee, that's
a different tone.
Has a different tone, doesn't it? But it's saying the same thing. Sorry?
I went to Sweeney Todd. Try the priest.
How so?
If you know the play, you would know. If
the priest?
Yes.
He's sort of a
barber who murders people and brings them into V5.
Oh, wow.
Oh.
Yikes.
Well, they're both saying we don't throw away all our issues. We work on them, right? Mm-hmm. We take them in and process them and transmute them. And it simply doesn't work to call up the internet and call up some company to come into our house, take all our garbage and cart it away so we don't have to use it. We have to deal with it. We have to clean it all up ourselves. And if it's a bloody mess, which is one way to look at it, we have to do that. So all practice is to reduce the grip of ego. Whatever language you use about it. Does that make sense, or have we got it all wrong?
Well, another way to say that is it's about awakening, right?
Certainly, yes. More?
Mm-hmm.
You have more on that?
Well, I wasn't going to say more.
You're welcome to.
But the issue being that throughout the practice, you know, we're waking up a little each time we practice. So no matter what part of the Dharma we're listening to, the central theme is about keeping us on that path.
Well said. Yeah. Whatever Dharma we're doing, basic meditation, Lojong, anything we're doing, any practice we could conceivably be doing, any teaching which is a Buddhist teaching is about waking up and having less of a grip of ego on our understanding, our activity, and our life. All Dharma agrees on one point. So boring. That's why we keep saying the same thing. We said it in Module 1, in Module 2, in Module 3. We're going to keep saying it. We don't have anything else to teach. All Dharma agrees on one point. If we really got that, well, then we wouldn't have to have a class, right? But we don't get it. We keep confusing ourselves, so it's said that there are 84,000 collections of Dharma, which sounds like a big number. But what that means is, since it's so hard to get that one simple thing, there are lots of ways of cajoling us, seducing us, whacking us, letting us dry out, whatever. All these different skillful means of getting to that one point. Colorful ones, drab ones, boring ones, wild ones, all Dharma agrees at one point. So we'll find a way to change the tone at some point too. Because this is not the only way.
If I could ask then something on your beautiful terse definition of grip, in whatever the phrase was that said, essentially, it comes down to a grip at something, a grabbing for something. Okay, so from the sounds of tonight, we bring in what we're grabbing at, and we make friends with it, and we accept it, or somehow there's an acceptance and a letting go at the same time. Sounds like a contradiction in terms, but it's certainly, you know, a subtle way of doing things.
We accept it, right?
Yeah,
that's
we
great.
Accept, say we have a habit that's undesirable. anger or whatever you want to temper. So we think instead of throwing it all out the window all at once, which is an easy thought for the health things to do, we work at it in small amounts. So, and we become friends with it. So when yes. one says to let it go, we've got to be less afraid of it, I guess is another way of saying it.
To experience it fully, yes, right?
Yeah, so the word grip sounds very tight, but it seems like a big issue.
Where does the word grip come from? It's not part. It's yeah, not the. It's not the, the instruction doesn't say to grip anything.
No, but you did about 5, 10 minutes ago. I thought it was a great phrase, but you used the word. Essentially, everything comes down to grabbing at something.
Reducing the grip of ego.
Yeah.
So we want to reduce the grip of ego, right? Okay, the practice isn't to grab something, it's to reduce the way that ego grabs us. And we do that by making friends with it, as you just said. By being willing to experience it, and then it can be transmuted and we can give out to others our basic sanity and calmness and equanimity. And it doesn't poison us to do that. That's something that's been a big issue, right?
Is the slogan "All Dharmas Agree" at one point? It seems very similar to drive all planes into one.
Drive all planes into oneself. Take full responsibility for our experience. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah? We're not going to avoid repetition here, for sure.
So if you're being friendly and making friends, then where does all the blood come in?
Where does all the blood come in?
Yeah.
The images you read.
I understand.
Is that the speed at which you take it on?
This is very traditional tantric imagery, and you may have seen it in tantra paintings, that ego is represented in all sorts of ways as something bloody and
messy,
being crushed, being eaten.
I don't know about other people, but I mean, I do have garbage in my mind. The bloody mess sounds pretty descriptive.
Yeah.
I think of you all have lovely, clean minds.
No.
That's bloody mess, I think, yeah.
None of us are any different, so.
Yeah.
So, we're making contact with that. We're acknowledging it by taking it in. And we find that within ourselves, our basic equanimity actually is there, and we can give that out without diminishing ourselves. Not easy. Not easy to understand. So we could move on. So here's the second one that you brought up, Megan. Of the two witnesses, hold the principal one. And the principal one is oneself. And the other witness is what people say about you. So what's going on here?
Keep the focus on yourself.
Well,
I like what Thomas said about that, you know, you're the only one who can tell if you're really doing the work, or you're just like acting like a nice person, or you're really, you know, being compassionate. You know, what's really happening, but it's what you know you're doing, because it's not, you know, like when you bring the gong at the beginning, we could all be making lists of things we're going to do tomorrow night. You can't see in our brains if that's all we did.
Right.
As long as we sit still.
Right? So we're the only person who really knows. Other people may praise us and say we're doing wonderfully, and we may see that there's something that isn't quite honest about that, right? That we really have some more base motive that we ourselves can see, even if others are saying, oh, you're doing such a great job. That's possible, right? So we don't want to get derailed by being praised. It's not that being praised is wrong, it's that we don't want to get confused if others say, oh, you're doing great. Or we might get blamed for something and we still have to see clearly that what we're doing is right, if it is right, and if we really know it's right, then even if it's upsetting people and they say, why don't you just go along with what everyone's doing, you're upsetting the boat here. We're all kind of going along with this and you're making trouble. You're being blamed. And it might still be right to go on making trouble.
What about the inner voice that criticizes oneself, the inner judge? I don't want to hold that one, personally. The one that anticipates what other people are thinking and then thinks the worst and goes all through that. I guess the trouble for me is distinguishing that inner critic from the wiser, more underlying inner awareness.
Right, that is the key question. Thank you. That is, if we're going to hold to the witness of our own wisdom, we really have to start to learn what is our wisdom and distinguish it from what is our egotism.
I had an experience 2 weeks ago that kind of speaks to that, I guess. I was on a yoga teacher training, and we were all in a room. It's the first day. I had no teaching experience at all. I've practiced yoga for a really long time, but no experience teaching. And the facilitators asked for a volunteer to get up and start teaching in front of everyone, and for some reason I raised my hand. And I got up there, and they just said, go. And I stood there, and the inner voice was like, oh my God, why did you stand up here? I don't know what to call, I don't know what to do. I've never done any of this. But I just stood there and paused. And then I taught a class.
Wow.
That's incredible.
It just happened. And then they stopped the class, and everyone, and the teachers and everyone started praising me. And I was like, but I didn't plan any of it. It just happened. So, and I just never trusted that. So I think that you kind of just have to let go of the fact that, or whenever you have that critic in your head. I think if it's critical, then I don't think it's your true wisdom.
That critic in your head is not your fundamental wisdom.
No, that's your ego.
No.
Okay. So yeah, so that's
fair. That's an important point.
Anything that's critical is your ego, because a critic is a separation device. You're separate. If you're a critic, then you are separate from everything else, and that's your ego. Because you're wisdom-minded, there's no separation. Everyone is one. Everything's one.
Yeah, it's very simple. The problem is that the critic sometimes gets you to good places in your life.
Good? To get you to good places?
Right.
Good.
I mean, I'm, you know, in some ways, there's a utility to the critic in certain places, but
the critic is really sensing something that needs to happen.
Sure.
So, you know, it could be even though it seems maybe critical, there may be a point of, okay, well, that's the direction I need to go in, or something. Even though you have no.
I can agree word. Sometimes.
Evermere.
It sounds like is talking through the creek.
Right.
There.
Yeah, so, yes, we do need to get to our original mind, not the self-conscious buzz on top of it. That's very true. For some of you who've been around with these teachings for a while, do you remember something called the eight worldly dharmas? Does anyone remember that?
It wasn't a picture, was it?
No. They come in four pairs, and one of the pairs was praise and blame. So these are the thoughts that keep buzzing in our mind. So we're sitting in meditation and or in any other situation, and our mind is busy with praise and it's busy with blame. We like praise, we want to avoid blame, and we're busy with being preoccupied with those, because those are all about the self, the ego. So a lot of what's being talked about here is equanimity, which is beyond praise and blame. It's not being derailed this way or that way.
When you were guiding us in meditation, you said very gently and no judgment. And then as soon as you said that, a voice in my head went, "What?" Then I laughed behind that, uh-huh. And it centered me back. Uh-huh. But it was like a really dramatic, like, "What? No judgment? What?"
Yeah, I mean, you start to see how mean you are to yourself. You know, would you be like that to anybody else or a child? I mean, it's so interesting, you know, why are we like that? I've been taking this writing course, this memory, I don't know, something. It's like a memoir course, I guess. And so you write and you bring something every week. And it's very interesting because you feel like, oh, I hope they like it. You know, like right away, you want to be praised. Like you feel it just comes up as this, and you don't want any negative comments. But actually, that's what you really want because it'll help you improve. But it's interesting. It's like this, like dancing on this razor's edge, you know, between hope and fear, praise and blame. And in the end, you really know, you have a sense whether what you wrote was really, you know, came across, sounded good or it didn't. But it's so interesting to kind of ride that edge and kind of notice. And that's when we do our meditation practice. That's why the shamatha practice is so important, because you start to see what's in your mind, and then you see the judgment and the criticism and all of it just is thinking, and come back to the breath. So that's what starts to undercut that whole process.
So, but I do find something contradictory, maybe, or just difficult to understand about, and I'm reading Kamen's book about this, that when she talks about ego, and when Michael Fagan talks about it, you sort of get the sense that you're supposed to get rid of it, and maybe I don't understand fully what the term really means in Buddhism, because on the other hand, kind of to your point, you're also asking about being a witness to yourself and getting the practice, doing the practice right, or at least doing the practice, and you're on the path of, you know, the right path. I mean, there's a whole sense of, there's a moral value to all of what we're doing. So when we talk about getting rid of the ego, I kind of resist that a little, because it seems like it's taking the metaphor a little too far. I mean, maybe this is what you were saying. I mean, there is a self in there that has, you know, judges or feels
knows what's the right thing to do and wants to be doing that, and that's part of our ego in a Western
construct. Yeah, and I think, I'm just thinking, went back, I was a psych major way back in the Dark Ages, and what I'm vaguely remembering is, you know, sort of ego integrity.
Yeah.
And which actually seems like it is almost what the Buddhist concept of trying to get would be comparable to ego integrity, where you're not being bombarded with the superego, which might be your critic, or, you know, the it is not, you know, the balance is there, and you're not.
Somebody must have done some writing on, like, Freud and Buddhism and how they intersect. I've thought about that.
That's a big topic, yeah.
Because I think that's where a lot of us are getting hung up, is the ego integrity was the goal.
Okay, so no one here, including Pema or Michael Fagan, ever said get rid of the ego.
Okay.
Ever.
Ever said what?
Get rid of the ego.
I guess the grip is different.
Loosen the grip of it, yes. Loosen the grip of that self-centeredness.
Self is different from, I mean, go ahead, sorry.
You could call it small self if you want. We call it self. And self is the same as the word ego in our teachings. And it's not our wisdom. It's not our wisdom mind. Beyond that, there is our wisdom mind. That's the one that actually knows. That's the one that can, that's the reliable witness. Mm-hmm. And the self-conscious bubbling of noise is not the witness.
I have a question. Would one say that wisdom is... Is this collectivity that is all within us and shared?
If it's one mind of the universe or something, Buddhism doesn't teach that. Hinduism might, but Buddhism certainly doesn't. Mm-hmm. So you aren't going to get an answer like it's this big universal mind or something. We have to start with the idea that whatever opinions we have aren't it. Whatever we think is ourself is our conceptual understanding of it. Our actual intelligence is beyond that, but it functions all the time. Our intelligence is right here, and it's not the noisy junk in our minds.
So what is the definition then of being completely awake? Or to be enlightened, is that no ego then, within that state and being completely present, or is it more what you're just talking about now?
Being completely awake is being present and having it effortless, yes, mm-hmm. and having a fully working intelligence, and having that intelligence not get derailed to the right or left, and having that intelligence spontaneously be compassionate, having that intelligence being completely clear, having that intelligence be completely generous, and so on. This is a description of Buddha, and the description of the potential Buddha that we all have. But that's just a description. So whatever we describe isn't, it's just a description. Let's move on, because now we come to an awful one.
Oh, really?
Always maintain only a joyful mind. That's slogan 21.
Oh.
You're going to take away my grumpiness? No way. What do you think of that? It's joyful because the path strengthens us, whatever happens. Whether something pleasurable happens or something painful happens, the adhering to the present, waking up, is beyond the pleasure and the pain of it. And it's a tremendous equanimity and ultimately a great joy. That's what it's saying. We don't like that, but...
Could you say, yeah, grateful instead of joy?
Yeah.
Gratitude is a bit, yeah, there's a nice part of that. Gratitude for just being here and awake. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's joyful.
Gratitude, but the joyful. You deal, or somebody you love or yourself has gotten a bad diagnosis, or, you know, there's just, life has its crises. But you can be grateful for things, but to be appreciative of being in the moment of having those bad things happen and being joyful about it seems like a stretch.
But I think it's about saying, like, if everything that happens, you can look and say, oh, that's terrible, or that's great. You know, it's like that one, good luck or bad luck, very soon to tell. Well, you could choose to just call it all good luck. You know, whatever's happened, you know, this is good because, you know, my family will take really good care of me, and I have to be able to see them, and I'm going to die sometime anyway, and this is better than, you know, I could have got hit by a truck last week when I crossed the nation.
True.
That, I agree with you, though. I mean, I struggle with this, too, that if you're with somebody who's really suffering, it's, I read in the book, you can use everything to learn to help yourself wake up, but in a sense, at some level, it feels a little heartless, for lack of a better word, to see a loved one suffering as an opportunity to, you know, to be awake, to be an awakened Buddha. And it's complicated. So
talk about ego.
Pardon me?
What did you say?
I said talk about ego. You know, I mean, it's sort of like saying, like, the situation you just described, that you're putting your, what you're getting out of it.
I'm getting something out of it.
Sort of,
I think that's ego. That's ego talking.
Right.
Though I don't think you necessarily.
That's very much ego.
When I think about stuff like that, it's so. If you bring it back to the moment, what is actually happening in something? If someone has a diagnosis of cancer, in the moment, if we're sitting next to each other, what's happening in this moment? There is no problem necessarily right now, and you can. You can be joyful in that moment because there's nothing wrong.
Or maybe not cancer, but somebody has. You're in one of the worst places in my mind to be is wait, saying in an emergency room, waiting for news.
Yeah.
And people, you can be grateful that everybody is taking good care, but the outcome is out of your hands, and it's a scary place.
I feel like I had a really easy time with this concept until I became a mom, and then and then it's like then, like, you know once you have a kid, I suppose you don't have to have a kid, but like I guess the depth of suffering in this world makes it hard for me to embrace this as realistic. Grateful, fine. It could always be worse, fine. But I don't really know where that gets us.
Well, it could always be worse, or people who are going to take care of me are sort of rationalizations, all of them, okay? This is not about any of that. It's completely beyond that. This is as painful as it can be, and I am simply there with the pain. And if something's pleasurable, I am there with the pleasure. But my mind isn't going to go off into gripping the pain or the pleasure.
So what does joyful mean
in
this context?
Because we're associating with pleasure.
I worked for 35 years in state hospitals, and people were dying of Huntington's disease, and they were tortured by their bodies. I mean, their bodies twisted and moved, and they couldn't really. It was awful, and they lost function continually. And there was no reward for it. There was nothing. You know, some people would say, "Oh well, God has a you know, a higher purpose. And I'm like, yeah, I'd like to hear it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it was the depth of misery that I experienced was traumatic for me, mm-hmm. even to be there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what these people were going through, I mean, it was so extreme that it's, yeah, I have the same problem.
Well, no one's telling you to do anything different, okay? It's you can only be there with that pain, okay?
But I'm supposed to be joyful. I'm supposed to have a joyful
well,
mind.
Well, you're going to have to drop the supposed to.
Because it says always have a joyful mind.
Yeah, so it's impossible. Okay.
Maybe the way perhaps to think about always have a joyful mind is be open, welcome.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Welcome it. Spacious.
Right. So you're welcoming in whatever happens. And in any case, we can't stop things from happening, right? They're coming in anyway. So instead of pushing away, it's saying, open the gate wider, let it in fully, experience it fully, and meet it. So it's actually coming up against, this is all about the Lojong, it's all the same message. Allowing what's unwanted access. It's you're opening the door, it's coming anyway, right? You're dealing with these people in the hospital, you're whatever situation. So it's that's the joy, actually, is the joy is opening to what comes rather than shutting down and pushing away. So when we shut down and push away, we're actually less available to people. And we're more stuck in ourselves and focused on our own, boy, this makes me uncomfortable. I'd rather just forget this. I'm never going to do this. Or I'd rather let somebody else take care of this friend because I don't want to be here. But if we can open to what comes, then we can be available, and we're less focused on ourselves and how miserable we feel because they're making me feel miserable. They can't help it, and I want to be here. You see the whole push-pull of the thing.
Yeah, I'm not so much talking about, I mean, my misery is, you know, I mean, I'm miserable, but how miserable must they must be? You know? But, I mean, and the only good part of it is being with them.
Right.
Yes, I mean, that is true. I mean, what you want to do is just fully be with them, you know, you hold them in your arms.
Right, and that's you're actually sharing your openness and joy that way. I mean,
sharing your pain.
It doesn't feel like joy. I can go with the sharing and the openness, and all of that makes perfect sense. It's the word joy.
Is there like a, does this come from the Pali or something? Is there like a different?
Is it a translation issue?
Yes. The Bible has all kinds of things.
So is it kind of more like not equanimity, but more like that? Like it's, yeah. I mean, I think we're seeing like, you know, joy to the world again.
Yes.
So, right.
So,
yeah.
It's not joy to the world again.
But that's what it sounds
right.
like. We're
right.
supposed to be.
That's in our mind what joy is.
Right.
It's only like what Pema said, that whatever happens, we are completely vulnerable to it. We can't shut down anything. And that's, to say that that's transcendent joy can only, we just have to let it happen and see what it is.
So that's the key, that word transcendent, or transcendent joy, that is really important. So it's not joy in the conventional sense. So that's how we're getting stuck here, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Joy makes us feel good, right? We feel
yeah.
joyful. So it's not joy in the conventional sense. It's transcendent joy.
What is transcendent joy again?
It goes beyond liking and disliking.
Okay. All right.
So all of these slogans all point to something beyond our usual way of thinking of them. And the words, yes, I agree. I mean, I don't know the original word here that was translated, and it may have many layers of meaning, and we may not be hooking into that layer of what's being expressed here.
It's still going to be the word joy in Tibetan, but yeah, but it's transcendent joy. It says joy, and we're talking about being completely vulnerable and open and having no defense about whatever happens, which includes pleasure. We can be, our mind can get knocked off kilter by pleasure as well as pain, so that we want to hold the pleasure just as we want to tighten up against the pain. So it's letting go of pleasure, not tightening against pain. Not so easy, but at the moment, we might find we actually have the courage to do it. Speculation isn't too helpful here.
I had once read basically an observation that was of a Buddhist monk that said, how can the Buddha have a smile when there's so much suffering? When I was young, I used to think, how can the Buddha have a smile on his face when there's so much suffering? And then later I understood that he understands it. He has that equanimity of mind and he helps transcend it, blessing the suffering of all those around him as well, too. So, I mean, that's the way I equate that. Those are very, very profound. You have to be totally selfless to get to that point where you're open. Mm-hmm.
So it's something to be worked on. So let's try to wrap it up quickly because I have an announcement afterwards. Slogan 22 says, if you can practice even when distracted, you are well trained. So it's kind of just amplifying that thought. Can we hold always a joyful mind when we get distracted by pain or distracted by pleasure? Probably not. It's not easy to do. So it doesn't say we should not get distracted. It says, if you can practice even when distracted, you are well trained. And what we find is that we aren't so well trained. And practice here is very essential. We have many layers of practice. We have the sitting meditation, the practice of no matter what comes up in our thoughts, pain, pleasure, avoidance, duty, hate, everything in our mind. We don't judge it. We come back to the breath. So we have that layer of equanimity. Then we have Tonglen, which I find even harder. Can we stay with taking in what we don't want and giving out what we want? I find that even harder to do, even for just a couple of minutes. It's very hard to do. But there is practice again. And then there's practice on the spot, no matter where we are. And here we can't afford to sit down and cross our legs or do whatever and breathe in and do this and that. It has to be, we've got it or we don't. So there are all these levels of practice. And the most basic practice is making it possible to motivate all these layers. So it's a practice and want and a motivation to practice and a motivation to be mindful, motivation to be aware, motivation to be compassionate, which is the fuel to being able to do all of this. So it says ultimately that the point here, the point five, is evaluation of mind practice, evaluation of Lojong. If we could actually not get knocked off our horse, then we would be very well practiced. And we get knocked off our horse, we shouldn't feel bad about that. Get back on our horse and practice. We aren't perfect. But we have an evaluation. We have starting to have a notion of how to know what we're doing and are we really doing it? And why are we doing it? And that's the whole point of point five. So if I talked you out of everything, I hope not.
I used to, or no, I still do, but not as often, but whenever I would get off the horse, or get knocked off the horse, and then I would realize that I was thinking or in some story, I used to always get angry at myself. Be like, oh my God, come on, get back, start being present again. But then the last few weeks, something just happened where whenever I would notice it, I would just be happy. Just be like, now I'm awake right now, and that's all that matters. Like every opportunity, every time you get off and you come back on, that's just an opportunity to be here. And I think that's the little shift. That is, the ego gets angry when you realize that you're no longer on the track. But when you shift back and you are happy, I think that's a big thing.
Maybe it's a big thing, and if it doesn't keep coming that way and goes back, well, then it wasn't such a big thing. We'll find out.
Right.
You don't know. Okay, so we've decided that we're only going to have one more class on Mojong. There are 37, to be precise, slogans we haven't talked about.
Oh no!
And we are not going to go boom 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 boom. We're going to just leave it open for whatever comes up. So here's an assignment. You have the book, whichever one you're reading. Most of you are reading Pema. Find some slogan because you understand it, or you don't understand it, or you think there might be something there that you just don't get, or it makes you angry, or whatever it is, find something that has some juice. Juice of upsetting you, juice of making you agree, whatever it is. And just come, and maybe that will be one of the offerings we'll take. We aren't going to take every one of them. We'll just take a handful of them. So in that way, we're going to stop teaching Mojong for now. It's far from over. You have the basics. You have a book. You can work on your own. And we will come back to it. But it's time to change the atmosphere. So next week, the last class of Mojong. The week after that, which is that would be April 23rd, we're going to watch a movie, not a Dharma talk video, but a real movie. And the movie is called Travelers and Magicians, and it is a very fascinating movie directed by Dzongsar Khyentse Rinpoche, and it's highly, well, I could say entertaining, wild, unbelievable, wakeful, colorful. Dzongsar Khyentse is a teacher whose mind is completely outside of the box. You never know what he's going to do. He's just wild and unpredictable. So we're going to see a movie, and let's not knock everything over the way I did before. And following that, we're going to go on to his book, which is called What Makes You Not a Buddhist, which is a strange way of putting it. But we're going back to the very basics, to like square one, and really talking about whatever we talked about at the very beginning, and doing it in a way which is... he's delightful in how he shocks us and says things we don't expect.
What's his name again?
His name, as given here, is Dzongsar Jamyang Khyentse, okay. To which I added the.
it's on the website now. So if you look at the homepage, it's on the homepage. So on the home page is the title of the book and the name of the author.
Okay, you can get the book in all kinds of ways, and hopefully Michael Fagan will have some for sale too. So that's the first class is then 3 weeks from today, so we have time to do that.
And then Lee and I will each be a year older. A year older today, right?
Yeah, well, my birthday is the 29th. When is yours? Oh, we have the same birthday? I forgot.
Me too. Roberta.
You too?
Every Friday night.
We have exactly the same birthday.
Exactly, 1947.
Wow.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
That's really amazing.
I mean,
yeah, we. Well, you do, but you're younger.